Welcome to the Voices of Women Physicians podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Tatiana Resnik, a practicing physician and a certified life coach. You will hear about inspirational journeys and practical tips from amazing women physician experts, as well as effective coaching and steps in your process. Welcome everyone to this episode of Voices of Women Physicians podcast. Today, I am so happy to invite you to a second part of our interview. And today, we will speak with Dr. Baumgartel. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Please tell us a little bit for our listeners who didn't have the chance to listen to previous episodes. Just tell us very briefly about yourself and about your book.
So I've been a physician for 30 years, can't believe it. Clinical medicine, internal medicine. And a few years back, I pivoted and started a new business about 2 years ago called My MD Advocate. So I take care of patients, but in a different way and do medical consultation advocacy in a telemedicine format. And I also have a separate website that I devote to menopause. I wrote a book. So it's really been fun to start this new chapter of my career.
This is wonderful. And in our last episode, we spoke about menopause and about helpful ideas and about your book. And we will talk a little more about this later on today. But I would like to learn more about this very unique practice, MyMD Advocate. Tell us more about this. What exactly is this?
Yeah, so it was brewing in my mind. I had some focus groups of patients and thought, well, how can I still be a physician but not do actual hands-on clinical care? So I was working through that challenge. And then I realized that what I've done for so many years in internal medicine, apart from managing medical problems and prescribing and doing physicals and so forth, was a lot of talk, a lot of discussion. And I thought, well, gosh, I can do that online, so in telemedicine. And so it became clear to me that a lot of patients are frustrated, like aren't we all, with our healthcare system. Maybe they have trouble accessing a doctor timely or just getting in with a doctor. Maybe they're confused by results or where to go or navigational issues. And so I realized that I could be of great service to them in terms of using my medical experience and my expertise. And with that lens, helping them make steps. And so I'm not taking them away from their current primary care doctors or their specialists or surgeons, but I'm helping them navigate that journey. So let's say they have a new diagnosis or something, I can help them decide where to get care. And maybe it's just a matter of math, like where their insurance will cover or where they live in the city or who's available, who's taking patients. So to us as a physician, that sounds not necessarily easy, but pretty basic. But to patients, it's not necessarily basic. And so those navigational skills, I think, were really coming into the forefront. People also see me for a lot of different things, too, and I'm happy to go into that. But that was that aha moment where I could really make a difference and be of service in a way that was pretty valuable.
I think it is wonderful you're doing it. Many patients are so confused what exactly to do, how to get things done. It's such a complex and actually really difficult for many people to understand system. It's wonderful you're doing it. And what are the common topics for which you provide medical consultations and advocacy support?
Well, when I set out to do it, I wasn't sure, but now it's been 2 years, I can see a lot of patterns. So people talk to me a lot about aging issues or menopause, of course. I do a lot of weight management stuff, preventive care in terms of like what to do when and how and why. Chronic disease management, not that I'm doing medications or managing labs, but just the bigger picture. It could be people with autoimmune conditions as well. Cancer survivorship, cancer support, where to go, how to get better support, navigating that. Caregiver stress, oh my gosh, that's huge. Coping with chronic pain, referral advocacy, even behavioral management. So all of that I can do without necessarily prescribing because I really can tap into what they're doing currently with their medical team and support that journey and augment it. And I think it's like a triangle in a way.
It is very important. And how do you help primary care and specialty physicians and surgeons when you work with them?
So that's really important to know because I'm not taking away, no one's leaving their doctor. And so what's happening is, as we all know, my physician colleagues are just working their tail off. They're working hard. They don't have time necessarily, especially if they're in a bigger environment. They don't have time. And so maybe they don't even have access. And so the patient's seeing someone else, maybe who's a non-physician or a covering doctor or even a nurse practitioner. And so I can put a damper on that frustration level. A great example would be if someone, let's say, has seen a cardiologist who's really busy and they just had 5 minutes in the room and here you go, take the Crestor, see me in 3 months. And the patient could leave and say, hands on hips, I'm not taking that drug. Or we can have a nice conversation that's like 1 hour long, and I can go through all the reasons why, you know what, I support your cardiologist, and here's why. These are all the risk factors. This is why you probably should be on, because these things didn't work, and here's what to expect. And I totally agree with the follow-up labs and so forth. So I'm backing them up, and I'm giving the patient space to have questions answered and to understand that this is probably a good idea. So I'm that hidden support in a way.
This is really helpful. This is wonderful. How exactly do you do it? Do you contact with specific doctor offices, or patients found you independently? How does it work?
Yeah, so good question. Patients find me, and often it's word of mouth because Seattle is a relatively small area. So being here so long, a lot of people know me, but usually the patient comes to me. And then of course, I'm still an active staff at one of our major medical centers, so I can look at their electronic records. And then I can see the story in terms of whom they've seen and what the recommendations were, and maybe review their labs with them. And then typically the patient decides that my notes are just for them. Every so often, they'll want me to forward my note to the specialist or the doctor and maybe the surgeon. And that's totally fine. I can do that easily. But often it's really for them. And so it's almost like I'm secretly backing everyone up in terms of giving the patient support and having them understand why their care is going a certain way. Every so often, it maybe is the other way. Like someone says like, oh gosh, I have to have a knee replacement. Is this right? And I say a good surgeon is probably never going to be angry if you get a second opinion. In fact, if it supports their opinion and their advice, then they actually like it because you've done your homework. And when you come to them to get your knee replacement, you know that you want them to do your knee replacement. So I think it also gives them support in that way, as an example. So I think the word of mouth is good. Of course, I have a website, but I don't have employees under me. I don't have other colleagues. So I'm at, and I don't mind that I'm working at a lower level than I used to be before, because I can just take more time. And if people want to see me today, I can see them today. So I'm not backed up.
It is awesome. And it is so important for patients to be able to understand deeply and to get this additional support when saying it. It is wonderful. And tell us a little bit more about menopause and about your book. So Menopause Menu, right?
Yeah, I'm so happy to have it out there in the world. It's the Menopause Menu, and I published it a few months back, self-published. It's on Amazon. And I really wanted a resource for everyone to have access to. And so, of course, women, but men as well, because everyone knows someone who's going through menopause, right? So it's a resource. So you get medical information, but it's also something that is very holistic and off the beaten trail. And it also has some artistic flavors. And of course, recipes. So there's a lot of things that it has in it. And I find that it's more than just a medical resource. It's like a gift book, coffee table, medical resource all in one.
Yes, it's wonderful. And talking about menopause, there are so many misconceptions, and sometimes it is confusing for people. So if you could help a little bit with dispelling some misconceptions.
Yeah. So I think menopause, first of all, the definitions are really important. And you and I know this, but honestly, some people are a little still unclear. So premenopause is all the years before you go into menopause. Peri means around, like perimeter. Perimenopause is around the time of menopause. And menopause, by definition, for women who still have a uterus, is 12 months without a period. So we're not talking about surgical menopause, which could be at any age, of course, but natural menopause, 12 months without a period, then you are literally postmenopause forever. So I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding, first of all, about what menopause really means. And then, gosh, there's one thing that I've noticed very much, probably in the last year or two more than ever, is this discussion about menopause in the workplace. And you can't even look at the New York Times or the Washington Post or some other expose. There's always a discussion, it seems, about menopause in the workplace. And I love that because it does need to be talked about more so we get some of the myths debunked. And it's not just like a hush-hush topic anymore. There are very legitimate things that women go through that need to be maybe not understood in great detail, but in a bigger perspective that people need to respect and understand. And also women need to understand so they can anticipate this and navigate that part of their life a bit better. And then, of course, I think also thinking about misconceptions, oh, there's so much out there in the, dare I say, Hollywood or other snake oil salesmen out there that can sell you anything and everything. Don't get me started on those pellets people get injected with. It's just a bunch of woo. It's actually dangerous. And so it's an opportunity to really think about evidence-based information that is full and not harmful.
Tell us a little more about menopause in the workplace.
Yeah. So when I think about not even just workplace, but when I was young, I probably was going through puberty when my mother was going through menopause. I didn't know she was going through menopause. No one talked about it. I mean, oh my God, especially culturally, right? So nowadays, someone is having trouble, let's say, with hot flashes. That's the most obvious because it's visual. They're going like this and they have their fan going. Then it would be nice to know that you can adjust your work environment. If you have a desk, if you're someone who has a desk, then you have a fan. But let's say you're a metro bus driver. Well, maybe you have one of those mounted fans. So you think about accommodations, perhaps that would be helpful. But then there are things that are not quite so obvious. Like if you have a really bad night or nights or weeks of nights, when you're not sleeping well and you're exhausted and that brain fog's going on. There have been studies looked at. I think the UK is ahead of us. They did studies in Great Britain long before us, but we've caught up. And if you go to the Menopause Society, there's a lot of great information too about women in the workplace leaving the workforce because they cannot manage and juggle all of this, all of those symptoms. So it's a big deal. And we look at the productivity and the dollar bill associated with it. We're talking the billions of dollars that are lost, women leaving the workplace. So I think this is now coming into the limelight in a really good way. And there are certain organizations that are already making some great strides. I think lots more has to be made to accommodate and just to educate, I think, too, because not everyone needs to have a major situation at work change, but I think more just an acknowledgement of it.
Oh, yes, that's important. And speaking about various studies and research, apart from hormone replacement therapy, which is obvious, what else has scientific research backing of effectiveness for relief of menopausal symptoms?
I love your question because although it's so easy just to talk about hormones all day, there are so many other choices or other things to consider. And it's not either or, they can be blended together. And so I think about things like nutritional changes, strength training, when you're thinking about your bone health or your musculoskeletal system, even your mental health support. For instance, another thing would be cognitive behavioral therapy. There's some good data looking at that in terms of sleep improvement. So all of those things are non-hormonal alternatives. There is one thing I think I would like to call out, and that's acupuncture. I've learned a lot about that over the years when I had a previous program called Menu for Change, and I hired naturopathic specialist and acupuncturist, nutritionist, and so learned a lot about weight management. But there's some really interesting studies. The data is kind of mixed. So there was one, I think 2017 meta-analysis, systematic review of 13 randomized controlled trials. And it looked at breast cancer patients. There are about 850 breast cancer patients. And that study found that acupuncture significantly alleviated menopause symptoms, but had no effect on hot flashes. Well, then another review, I think this was 2016, looked at a randomized controlled trial and it involved maybe around 200 perimenopausal and postmenopausal women, 45 to 60. And it found that acupuncture actually reduced vasomotor symptoms, aka hot flashes, and also improved quality of life measures. So you can say, well, yes or no, there's evidence. I think it comes down to the individual. And so some people absolutely love acupuncture, use it for many different things, and it definitely helps them. Other people try it and said, yeah, not my cup of tea. And so it is another option. It's not all 100% evidence-based scientific proof, but it definitely has a use. So if it doesn't hurt you and you're going to someone who's reputable, why not?
Yes, it's true. Which symptoms it helped? So apart from hot flashes, which symptoms it did help for sure?
It depends on the person, of course, but I've seen people who definitely benefit first from quality of sleep or sleep restfulness, management of pain. So if they have joint problems or body pain or migraines or headaches or things like that, for fatigue and mental support, sometimes it can help with anxiety and other things. Hot flashes, depending on the person. So again, it's a mixture of things, but I think those are the more common uses for it.
This is so interesting. And how about soy product and all this controversy? Sometimes they tell us not to use them since they told actually do use them.
Yeah, I'm one of these people that I'm not all or none. You probably figured that out now. And so I feel like, yes, there's no hardcore evidence that if we just all took soy products and had edamame and tofu and soybean and all that, that we're not going to get rid of our hot flashes. But it sure can't hurt. And I think it does help support in some ways. It's also tofu and things like that's a good source of calcium. And you get other micronutrients from things like soy or edamame. So again, it's not like it's a prescription. Go have soy, you're going to be fine. But I think if you incorporate it into some of your foods, and actually that was one of my recipes. So in chapter one, which is all about hot flashes, you get a recipe for miso soup with tofu, green onions, and seaweed. So it's really yummy and really easy.
This sounds interesting. This sounds yummy and healthy. Some protein and some calcium.
Exactly.
It's awesome. What else helps? What else has scientific backing? Is that it actually helps?
Yeah, I would say again, there are medications, of course. Certainly, there's a lot of good data now about hormones. In fact, so many women and maybe even physicians are stuck in an era. Remember back in 2003, 2004, when the Women's Health Initiative came out and everyone everywhere said, oh, stop taking hormones. And of course, everyone went crazy. And it was a very bad era. And I think looking back now, hindsight's 2020, we've learned that data wasn't necessarily flawed. It was the interpretation of it and also actually the aggregate use of it. So looking at the population. Fast forward to now, when we look at hormone therapy and specifically thinking about estrogen, that can very much be supportive in many ways: hot flashes, vaginal dryness, urinary difficulties, mood, potentially brain function, although we're learning as we go now. There are more studies. You know, I guess that's the good point, is there's lots more research now than ever. And there's finally so much more focus on women's health and women's issues, especially in this perimenopausal phase. So I love that that's happening. New companies are inventing new drugs. I think Veozah is a new one that's for hot flashes. That just came out last May, I think. So it's nice to see those options, especially if someone really is having a tough time and or just wants to say, cut to the chase. I want to take something. I want to get effect from it right off the bat before I go into menopause so I get more lasting effect. This is all stuff that's pretty new compared to even 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. And I think I like this because we're all learning and we're upping our game.
Oh, yes. And talking about weight management and menopause, it's such a common symptom when it's so hard to lose weight. So what helps?
Wow, this is my favorite subject because I ran a weight management program for 7 years before this. I think, again, I start with the bigger picture. So you think about weight and body image and things like intuitive eating or all those medications now. There's so many medications out there that are fairly new and medical conditions, all that swirling around when you think about how to better manage weight. And I do start off with, honestly, the five pillars. So you think about nutrition, a nutritional approach, not a diet, but nutrition. You think about exercise. In fact, I actually talk more about movement than I do exercise. I think it's less punitive. You think about sleep. We've talked a little bit about sleep and the importance of it. Oh my gosh, if you're not sleeping well, there's no way you can lose weight very well. Stress, yeah, duh, that's the 600-pound gorilla. Managing stress in your life is huge. And then intertwined in all of this, I think about social connection, how we relate to others. Oh boy, it gives us meaning, it gives us value, it gives us passion, it gives us joy. Those are all so essential, I think, for managing weight. So this is not like a diet. There's no like one size fits all. And if you just ate this or just did that, you're going to be fine. But then I also don't shy away from thinking about what I call the microcosm. I think about what's going on at the cellular level, the hormones. We've learned about leptin and ghrelin and sleep patterns. We've learned about glucose control or insulin resistance or sensitivity. We think about the nervous system. Oh my gosh, the brain controls everything. Our gut microbiome, that is just huge. So all of those, again, are so intertwined with how we think about weight. And I could talk an hour about each one of those, but I think that's why it sometimes feels a bit overwhelming and a bit daunting. Like, oh my gosh, I thought I was a smart person. Like, I can't handle this. So working with someone who can help you navigate some of those things, not that I prescribe medicine anymore for weight management, but there's definitely value for those people who meet the criteria and it would work. Absolutely for people who are struggling with huge weight gain and can't manage it, or they're pre-diabetic or diabetic. And then just being back and saying, we don't need to be all stick thin. In fact, I don't think that's healthy. What's our body image? What makes us function well in a smart way that we're thinking about the future in terms of preventing disease? And so that's a lot of words, but that's my response to the weight management question.
Absolutely. I'm lifestyle medicine certified too, so I very much agree with everything what you told about importance of five pillars. And it's actually in any age, it's really helpful for weight management and really for everything else. Anything specific for menopause, anything extra which could help in this period of time?
I'd say it's more anticipatory. So when you think about menopause, when is it happening? Typically, it's happening as we're going into midlife. Well, what else is happening in midlife? Our behaviors are often changing. Maybe we haven't prioritized things like movement, or maybe we haven't thought seriously about better nutrition. Maybe we haven't been to the doctor, and so we're not getting screening medical tests and annual physicals or so forth. Maybe the stress is just getting out of control, and we're not managing as well as we should or that we could do it. So it's putting a little pause button in place and saying, wow, as I'm journeying into this new phase of life, what can I do differently that will improve my health? And oh, yeah, improve my approach to weight management. So it is not like there's one single thing that's going to work better. I do find, honestly, and I'm not preaching to anybody here, but many women are discovering that alcohol maybe is not their friend anymore. And it used to be socially fun and actually like a relief, like, oh, I can relax at the end of the day. But that's one thing to think about. By the way, it's empty calories. By the way, it may cause disinhibition that you're not going to make great choices, maybe nutritionally or just lifestyle wise. But there's some interesting data out there now that's a bit scary. Like, for example, younger people getting colon cancer at younger ages, like early 40s or mid 40s. And so when you start screening, it used to be 50, now 45 is, but there's maybe 10 or 15% of cases that it's not familial, it's not lifestyle. And I'm starting to think, and some of my GI doc friends are thinking that maybe it's impact of alcohol. So that's one single example that maybe if you backed off on or looked at a different way, it might serve you in a lot of good ways, including weight management.
Oh, absolutely. And if you could give us a couple of tips from your book on managing menopause.
Well, I will actually refer to my section. So each of 16 chapters is set up like a fine dining experience in a restaurant. So there's like an amuse-bouche, there's like an appetizer, there's the entree, which is all of the main information. There's the palate cleanser, which is the recipe. And then there's dessert, which I love dessert. So the dessert section is like a wild card. I mean, there's like blooper reel, there's a menopause menu bingo. There's a lot of fun things. But when I think about tips for my book, I think about what I call menabits. I coined that term, like bits of wisdom. So menabits is each chapter has like, if you just had 1 minute or maybe 2 minutes and you wanted to look at one chapter, you don't have time to read, you just want to get a couple of tips. So you go to that page. And so I could just look up at any chapter, but like menabits for night sweats. So one is hormone fluctuations and estrogen decline are primarily to blame. That's true. So it's sharing a bit of information, like you're not going crazy. It's the fact that your estrogen is down here and that's why you're having all these hot flashes and night sweats. Another one would be, don't forget to hydrate, hydrate, hydrate. Well, it sounds like a statement of the obvious, but we're behind the eight ball on that one. Imagine we're going about our day, we may be sweating a little bit and we're busy and I have my nice tall cup of water, but when was the last time I took a sip? So it's still tall. We're running around a little dehydrated and we're not realizing it. So that has impact on night sweats. Oh yeah, it has impact on your mental status too, your tolerance for things, on your energy. So a big ripple effect. Another one would be a sense of humor can definitely help. Ooh, I like that tip. I think that's true for almost any of these chapters and maybe a truism for life. But those are little examples of how you get these little bits of takeaway points that can help you give advice on the fly.
I love it. Thank you so much. And if you could tell us how to contact you, what's the best way to contact you for our listeners for both areas, for those people who would like to learn more about your book and for patients who are interested in your advocacy work.
So my business is set up for patients in Washington State. So if you're in Washington State, you can go to my website, which is called My MD Advocate. Anyone can read it, but you can click on the contact information. And you can also find my email address and my phone number. So I'm glad to have contacts from any states. But if people are interested in working with me. And then I have a LinkedIn profile, of course, a business connection site. So people can find me on LinkedIn. My free website is Menopause Menu. And that includes lots of information as well as a bunch of blogs, which are always fun. I also have a Menopause Menu Facebook page. I have a YouTube channel. So at dr.susanfallongirdle. And then of course, my book, which is The Menopause Menu, you can get on Amazon. And I'm just delighted if people want to reach out to me in any way.
Thank you so much for coming and for sharing all of this. It's so awesome. You're doing good. Thank you. Thank you for listening to my podcast. If you enjoyed it or found it helpful, please subscribe, leave a 5-star review and share it with a friend. Have any topics you'd like covered? Send me an email at joyfulsuccessliving@gmail.com. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram to connect at joyfulsuccessliving. Have an amazing week. See you next time. The Voices of Women Physicians podcast is for entertainment purposes only and does not provide any medical, financial, tax, legal or psychological services or advice. You are responsible for your own well-being, decisions and results. Dr. Resnick is a practicing physician, but Voices of Women Physicians podcast is not reflective of the opinion of her employer. You should always contact a professional if you have any specific questions about your unique situation.